This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, so tonight on Sportsnet Pacific, it is the Vancouver Canucks facing off against the Anaheim Ducks. Just a couple of things here. We've been talking plenty about Bo Horvat lately, both on and off the ice. On the ice, tied third most goals in the NHL this season with 8. You go back to March 9th last season, 29 points in 28 games, 22 goals, 7 assists. When you add up the last 2 months of last season and the first month of this season, Bo Horvat's .79 goals per game, the most in the NHL. Bo Horvat, number one, .79. Connor McDavid, number two, .76. Kirill Kaprizov, .73, is third. Austin Matthews, fourth at .7. Leon Draisaitl of the Oilers at .67. Horvat, by the way, has 26.7% of the Vancouver Canucks goals this season. And yes, because you're wondering, Erik Karlsson has 31% of San Jose Sharks goals so far this season. Meanwhile, turn our attention now to the Seattle Kraken. Dare we say the surprising Seattle Kraken with a pretty impressive record of 5-4-2 after 11 games, 12 points, third in the Pacific. Allison Lucan knows that better than I do because she covers this team on a regular basis. She's an analyst for the Seattle Kraken, also one of the co-hosts of the Too Many Men podcast, along with Sarah Sivian and Shayna Goldman. Allison Lucan joins me now. Hello, Allison.
Well, hello, Jeff. How are you?
I am well. Do you want to get the elephant in the room right out of the way quickly and then move on?
What's the elephant? Let's go.
No, it's an elephant who plied his trade once upon a time with the Don Mills Flyers and then the Kingston Frontenacs of the OHL, drafted fourth overall in the first round in Montreal by the Seattle Kraken and general manager Ron Francis, who can't find his way into the lineup, and that is Shane Wright. Do we know his status for this evening? I'm guessing he plays, but Seattle's coming off a big win against Calgary, and you know the mantra around hockey since forever, never change a winning lineup. What's happening tonight?
Yeah, we do not know as of right now. The Kraken have just taken to the ice a little bit ago here in Minnesota, so we'll see what Dave Hakstol has to say when he talks to us after. It's kind of a conundrum because, as you say, Jeff, this is a team that's playing really well and deriving a lot of confidence from that right now, and Hakstol has not switched his lineup for these last couple games. And what's very interesting and what I think makes it even more difficult is that the fourth line as currently constructed, which is where Shane Wright has seen most of his minutes, is really part of the powerhouse, part of the offensive engine for this team right now. So it's kind of hard to make a case to take any of those three guys out.
How is the market? I mean, outside of Seattle, I mean, everyone's looking at this and scratching their heads. This guy is fourth overall. You know, he's a Cadillac player. He's one of the future pillars of this organization. How can he be treated like this? But then to your point, you know, this team is playing really well, specifically a couple of nights ago against Calgary. And right now, if you're Dave Hakstol and the Seattle Kraken, you make hay while the sun is shining here. How is the Shane Wright story resonating with Kraken fans? Because everyone outside of Seattle kind of looks at this sideways and says, what's happening here? How do Kraken fans feel about this one?
Yeah, I think, you know, just like any fan base, you're going to have a lot of opinions. There's certainly a very loud segment of voices that say, you know, we trust in Ron Francis. And, you know, he has a track record going back to even Carolina of handling young players and working with them and identifying talent. I certainly think that Ron is well aware of the talent he has in Shane Wright and will handle this the very best way possible. And a lot of fans are there, but there are a lot of fans too who are on anywhere of the spectrum of, we just want to see him play, right? Because we've heard he's going to be a cornerstone of this team going forward. And there's always some people who think they can be GMs, but, you know, no one's calling my phone and asking me to run a front office at any level. So we've always got those who just want to tell us what they think we should do.
Everybody on your podcast could run an NHL team. You know that, and anyone's listened to it knows that that's true. Let me ask one more thing here about Shane Wright, and really it's a question about Ron Francis. So your piece last weekend on the Kraken website was, first of all, was an excellent piece. Second of all, it's very rare that pieces on teams' websites become really newsworthy right away. And I'm not sure... I mean, I guess you could interpret it in a couple of different ways here, Allison. Ron Francis's assertion that Shane Wright playing 6 to 7 minutes a night was, quote, not ideal. Did you interpret that as it's a shot at the coach or it's a shot at the player, i.e. the coach needs to play him more or does Shane Wright need to earn more ice time? How did you see that comment?
Yeah, you know, as I when he said it to me, I didn't, my antenna didn't spring up or anything like that. I think that as with anything, even any stat, you know, context matters. And when Shane Wright was seeing the ice, yep. This team was playing well, but wasn't getting the points. And, you know, this is a group that for many reasons wants to be and should be better than last year. And, you know, when you're in a dogfight and games are coming down to the wire, I certainly can understand a coach saying I need to go with, you know, who's rolling that night or who can handle these tough assignments against some of the top teams in the league. I mean, this Kraken team started their season. They played every other day for the month of October, and they went up after Anaheim. They saw the Kings, then the Golden Knights, then the Hurricanes, and then the Blues, and then the Avalanche. So I certainly have time for understanding that that is not the ideal schedule into which you roll out an 18-year-old rookie just coming to the NHL.
That's a really good point. Okay, off the Shane Wright page and onto the Matty Beniers page. Holy smokes. What a start to the season. 9 points, 5 goals. Already we're coming out of October and we're saying, Calder Trophy. You know, it's certainly within reach. A lot of people had suggested in preseason polls or predictions that, you know, they could see Matty Beniers winning this thing. Has formed a really nice battery with Jaden Schwartz and Jordan Eberle. Your thoughts so far and what you've seen after 11 games with Matty Beniers?
Yeah, you know, it's one of those situations where, you know, we've seen young players come into this league and we know that their first full season can be full of a lot of ups and downs. So I keep saying, well, let's wait and see how this goes. Give it time. But every game, it's like he's hearing me and saying, you're wrong. Shut up. So he doesn't look out of place, right? And that's what's impressive about his game, his composure, his ability to slot right into that top six grouping. Game winner, the first of his NHL career in Calgary just a couple of days ago. I do honestly still believe that, you know, there's going to be some stretches where, whether it's fatigue or whether it's, you know, everyone loses the scoring touch here and there, regardless of how well you're playing, there's going to be some stretches for him to have challenge and react and grow from that. But he is, and again, we talked about Shane, to have these two cornerstones come into an organization through the draft. I mean, we know teams that have done center depth this way and it works out pretty darn well.
No, it's a tried and true. I mean, listen, these things, I think the Shane Wright just kind of fell into Seattle's lap. I don't think that they necessarily thought, hey, you know, we're going into Montreal, we're coming out with Shane Wright. It's more like, holy smokes, we went to Montreal, we came out with Shane Wright. This is kind of incredible. You know, I think a lot of people in New Jersey scuttled that early. I think everyone sort of circled Simon Nemec as someone that the Seattle Kraken may have wanted coming out of the draft. One more thing about Matty Beniers. Are we sure he's 19? Because he looks like he's about 30. And maybe 35, Allison. I don't know that I've ever seen a 19-year-old look as mature as Matty Beniers does.
You know, I'll have to ask to make sure that we've checked his birth certificate, since that seems to be the growing trend. But it really is amazing. And I think that what's fun is to watch him away from the ice. You know, he seems to really be enjoying this. And there's little glimpses that this is still a guy, you know, learning and enjoying things for the first time. I mean, the smile that came on his face when he talks about seeing Eberle come down the side about ready to set him up for that game winner in Calgary, and just the delight in that experience he's still figuring a lot, doing a lot of this for the first time. But I'll make sure and confirm his actual birth date.
You know, some really deft moves in the offseason as well. I thought the Burakovsky deal, and that's already paid off in dividends. I thought that was a really nice bit of business by the Kraken. Bjorkstrand, I mean, you talk about players falling into your lap. Columbus signs Johnny Gaudreau out of nowhere, and it's, you know, it costs them Oliver Bjorkstrand, but there's Seattle there to absorb it. When you look at the moves that Francis made this past offseason, you know, what jumps out to you as the ones that, you know, are, you know, early season home runs for the Kraken?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, now look here, even the signing of Martin Jones to come in for an injured Chris Drieger paid off in spades for this team already with now Grubauer being out. But, you know, people will say I'm biased here, but when the Bjorkstrand trade went down, I was just thrilled. Obviously, I covered him in Columbus, and when we were there, we talked for years about how he was one of the most underrated players in the NHL because of what he can do. And the reason that trade is probably my pick is not just the caliber of the player that they've gotten, but the price they paid. I mean, that's insane. We all know why. Oh, yeah. We all know that it was, you know, the Johnny Gaudreau signing that forced Jarmo's hand. But that's, if you had said to me Jarmo Kekalainen would part with that player for that price, I would have told you were crazy. And Bjorkstrand is not only coming as advertised, the points haven't come yet, but all the underlying numbers are there. He's awakening even more in Alexander Wenberg's game, which has been really fun to watch as well.
I want to ask you about the goaltenders, because you mentioned Martin Jones, and you know he's 4-3. The Seattle Kraken have a winning record right now, third in the Pacific. I want to ask you about Joey Decord, and I know this might be getting into the minutiae of the Seattle Kraken here, but he was one of those players that in preseason I was really wondering about, because I wasn't sure that this guy was going to clear waivers. I mean, we all know what waivers are like. We all look at, ooh, juicy, this guy's going to get claimed. He doesn't get claimed. Oh, this guy, there's no way he's going to clear. He clears. But I looked at Joey Decord, and I looked at how many teams around the NHL were looking for a goaltending help, specifically for a backup, and I said, I can almost see Seattle putting Martin Jones on waivers before they put Joey Decord. When they put him on waivers, how much did Ron Francis and everybody else in Seattle hold their breath?
Well, I'm gonna go into the minutia with you there, Jeff, because I was with you. I think everyone who follows this organization was watching, and we all know that as training camp comes to a close, GMs are trying to time that market, and you know. The Kraken already had lost Hellberg over to Ottawa, and then they put Joey on, it seems right, and no one will remember this but me, but that was the day John Gibson left their game, and I had a reaction that wasn't entirely positive to that, because we didn't know at the time what his status was going to be. Yeah. And I, too, think that he's someone that other organizations are paying attention to, but I also, you know, with full marks to the player, I can also see that this is a player that other organizations might be saying it'd be great for him to get a little bit more seasoning before he comes into an NHL roster, and waivers precludes that, obviously. So I think he skated through due to timing, and just a little bit more seasoning would be really great for him.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I wondered about Philly. I really did. I wondered about Philadelphia with Joey Decord. I'm like, how does Philly not put in a claim? But nonetheless, maybe this is why I'm not a general manager. One other player that I want to get your thoughts on, and I'm curious because I believe teams have called for him in the past, I believe around trade deadline, and that's Carson Soucy. Like, I know that Carson Soucy isn't Adam Larson or Jamie Oleksiak or, you know, Justin Schultz. Like, he's not one of the headline guys. He's a depth defenseman. Who does have some bite in his game as well. And I've always said, like, having a player like Carson Soucy on your bottom pairing is kind of a luxury, because he does things that a lot of bottom pairing D don't do. Do you have a thought on what Carson Soucy means to this team?
Yeah, I agree with you, Jeff, and I would hire you as a general manager if I ever had the authority. But, you know, Carson Soucy is part of what I think are some just really nicely balanced pairs. You know, they have three right-handers on the right, three left-handers on the left, and Carson Soucy has been playing with Will Borgen in that third pair. And, you know, what's impressive about those two is if you look at some of the underlying numbers, like MoneyPuck.com has them, I believe, last I checked, top 10 in terms of tilting the ice in terms of offensive quality. So when they're on the ice, they are one of the top 10 pairings in the league right now in terms of making sure the ice goes the Kraken's way. Yeah, so I think that now watch me go check, and they will have moved around since I last looked. But it's a really impressive start for these two. And I think what's happening that couldn't happen last year up and down this Kraken lineup is they're finally starting to capture that magic in a bottle that comes when you actually get to hold your pairings and lines together for some time and they can get that chemistry. Dave Hackstall talked about that chemistry matters most in the hardest moments, because that's when you're under pressure and that's when you don't have to think. You just know exactly where your line mate or your D partner is going to be. And I think we're seeing so much of the benefit of that right now.
You know, every team has a different expectation. Every team has a different way that they judge what a good season is, what a bad season is. You know, it's the old, old saying, one person's ceiling is another person's floor. I get that. What will qualify as a good season for the Seattle Kraken?
Yeah, I mean, obviously they want to be in the postseason conversation, but we can look at the Pacific and see that the competition that is there and know that this Kraken team has a lot of really strong building blocks, but the window is maybe just a crack open now in terms of their contention. They're still building towards that, if we're being honest, but right, a winning season would be huge, and meaningful hockey in March and April would be a massive, massive step, particularly in a market that boasts a lot of professional sports. So you want to grab those fans' attention and, let's be honest, dollars too. So that would be a win for me this year and continued improvement. I think what's really fascinating to me right now, after that win in Calgary, if you look at the numbers, that was one of those games that if it wasn't for some timely saves by Joey Decord and then some opportunistic offense late, the Kraken probably shouldn't have won that game. But it's those kind of games when you gut it out and you find a way to win. That's the kind of intangible a group needs to take the next step. And I think they really did that in Calgary. It'll be interesting to see what they do in Minnesota tonight.
Let me conclude by asking you about Minnesota. There's a lot of players on that team that I really like. I really like Joel Eriksson-Ek. Everybody loves Kaprel Kaprizov. Matt Boldy is looking so legit. Can he do it without Kevin Fiala? Yes, he can do it without Kevin Fiala. Whether it's Jared Spurgeon, go right down the list. There's a lot of reasons to like the Minnesota Wild. You don't like their cap situation. They're in cap hell. We all know that. But this is still a competitive and really scrappy team. From your research, here's a squad that's third in the Central. Seattle is third in the Pacific. What is Seattle in for tonight in mini?
Yeah, it's going to be a very different look from coming off those speedy rushing and forechecking Flames that they just dealt with. But what's interesting to me is I'm going to watch to see how the Kraken focus on the Wild's transition game. I mean, they basically have three players, Eriksson-Ek, Boldy, who you mentioned, and Yost, who are their transition people, who do the hard work of the zone entries and lead their team in that effort. They're actually not getting a ton of transitional support from their defenders proper. There's not a lot of movement happening off that first pass or even that exit from your blue liners. So since this is quote unquote not a rush team, I want to see how the Kraken attack them in terms of their forecheck and in prohibiting the Wild's ability to transition. Because again, if you get that puck on the stick of some of these talented forwards, I mean, Kirill is called the Thrill for a reason, and they have to keep him quiet however much they can.
Yeah, good luck with that one. No one's been able to do it, but I wish the Seattle Kraken the best. Allison, you're the best. Thanks so much for stopping by, as always. You're so great at everything you do. Continued success with the podcast. I do not miss an episode, although we're shy when Allison Lucan with the latest. And enjoy the game tonight, Seattle Kraken and the Minnesota Wild. You be well.
Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate you. You're the best.
Allison Lucan, Kraken analyst, also one of the co-hosts with the Too Many Men podcast, which is outstanding. All right, coming up in hour two, we should probably get into some of the games going on around the NHL this evening. We got 13 of these, and the marquee matchup around the league is probably, it's got to be New Jersey and the Edmonton Oilers. I don't think anyone's going to call this one, Stanley Cup preview time, but New Jersey's such a much improved squad. If you've listened to the show for, any amount of time, you've probably, grown sick of me talking about the Devils and specifically Nico Hischier, but that is going to be an outstanding game. We're all very curious about Vancouver. Whether you're listening in Vancouver right now, you're a casual observer of the Vancouver Canucks, or maybe just a fan of hockey chaos, you want to see the Vancouver Canucks face off tonight against the Anaheim Ducks, who now, by the way, have just won two games in a row. Early, the Hurricanes and the Lightning are intriguing. Vegas goes for their 10th win in a row, as do the Boston Bruins, with two undefeated netminders going head-to-head, Shesterkin and Linus Ullmark. should be a really good game tonight. A lot of good games this evening. 13 of them. We are back with Mike Fuda in a couple of moments here. Gary Lawless coming up bottom of the hour to talk about the Knights. Merrick Show continues. Hour 2 is coming up. Keep it here.
Great daily gambling advice from Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert in the Fan Morning Show's Wake and Rake. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
13 games tonight around the NHL. Should be a fun evening, whether you're watching early or watching late. I mean, late we got New Jersey and Edmonton. That one should be total banger. Vancouver and Anaheim. Watch that one on Pacific. Oilers-Devils on Sportsnet West. Sportsnet 1, you can see the Flames and the Predators early. Hurricanes and Lightning looks great. Bruins and Rangers looks tasty as well. I think we're all wondering about Shane Wright with the Seattle Kraken. Is he in or not? If he's not, that's five scratches in a row. Oof. Seattle faces off against the Minnesota Wild. Being joined now by one of our favorites, one of my favorites, and one of the sharpest minds in the game. He is Mike Fuda, and he knows it at the NHL level. He knows it at the junior hockey level. He knows it at the international hockey level. And that's how you wanted me to read it, right, Mike?
I think, though, you're missing one thing, but that was pretty good. That was pretty good.
What's that?
I think you missed one point, but that was pretty good. That was a pretty good start. I appreciate it, Jeff. I wanted to congratulate you. I saw you out there dropping the puck in Stouffville with your kids, and that was awesome.
Hey.
Kudos to you. Job well done.
Listen, That was raising money for Team Dog Rescue. That's a group that my family's worked with for a number of years. And I'll tell you, it was a real trip. Kenny Burrows is, owner, GM, everything there with Stouffville. And he's like, you want to take your kids out too? I'm like, can I? He's like, oh yeah, sure. So we dropped four pucks and it was a big dad moment feud. So I really love it. And Stouffville spirited by hometown OJHL team. So that was really cool. Now you were at the Philadelphia Flyers Toronto Maple Leafs game last night. We'll start with broad strokes. What were your main takeaways from last evening in a game that really the Maple Leafs really needed to have?
Well, I mean, I listened to you with Elliot, and I mean, I sat there. This is one of the few times I actually got to sit there and, have a beer with a friend of mine and Marty McQueen from the Keg and enjoy the game, take it in. And the things that you see from it, one, obviously, the only two games I've seen so far this year where I have my daughters down for a charity event, the first for the Arizona game, which was absolutely painful. Like, it was just tough to watch. They didn't bring their effort, and the team that they shouldn't even be in the same ice with came away with points. So, obviously, a lot has unfolded since then, and the pressure on this game seemed to be way more than any other normal regular season game against the team that played the night before that you should beat by all accounts anyways. But I was really happy for Sheldon because the one thing that was clear, there was an effort. This wasn't a team that came out and just laid their sticks down. And I was happy for Tavares, really, because, it's not an easy place to be a captain or a leader in. And I think that for a while, as much as we can look back and talk about how many shots and how they were great, at one point when Samsonov let in that kind of softie on the short side, and they put themselves in a chance where one bad play or one lucky play or one bad break, and for some reason Samsonov had gone from looking like a wall and a pillar to that last little bit there. He just seemed to not have his A game. He wasn't finding pucks the way he had been previously in the game, and they came down, I think, kind of put one off the bar, and I'm like, oh, man, please don't allow this team to sleepwalk back in, because they were working. And Tavares took it upon himself to score one of those goals that only a special player like that can score, and the rest was history. I mean, I loved it. I thought the energy was there. It's amazing the in-house emotions of Leaf fans that just shake my head. Like, I was talking to my buddy about something and my thoughts on something about his Nylander contract, and the guy's like, just some guy starts barking at me in a Nylander shirt. He's like, he's awesome. Don't talk about it. And I was like, it was like, you get that. And I'm like, it's just such a sensitive group right now. And then, like, you get a kid like Justin Hull that's going out there. And I mean, He at one end, he basically saves a goal in the crease, and he's struggling so much, and then a couple pucks get away on him, and he gets booed off the ice. And it's like, and that's the life of, a Toronto Maple Leaf when things aren't going well. But all in all, They won a game they were supposed to win. I still have many thoughts on the identity of this team that really concerns me moving forward, but they did what they had to do. I'm a little bit more with Elliot at the and yourself. I know, you know, I have a different way I would build a team personally and the way we drafted and stuff like that. But I think at that end of a game where you're winning 5-2 against a team that's loaded with machine guns, it's a pretty easy time to just sit Matthews in the bench and let him get ready for the big weekend.
Well, pause on that for 1 second, Fuse. And actually, we're gonna give you a buzz back because your line's kind of crackling a little bit. We're gonna try to get you here on a cleaner line because there's a lot of things in there that I want to sort of pull out and pick apart. And I do want to get your thoughts as well on the Philadelphia Flyers from their side of things, being drained by Mike Fuda, just getting them back on a better line here. Longtime NHL manager, longtime scout, longtime former general manager in the OHL, has graduated a lot of players into the National Hockey League, and then through his work with various organizations, helped graduate them to the NHL. With us now on the NHL on Sportsnet, there was a few things coming out of that one. Like on the one hand, it was another really good night for John Tavares, who very quietly, and I know he always gets wrapped on foot speed, who very quietly is putting together a really nice season for the Maple Leafs. I mean, you can make the arguments that, you know, maybe, you know, the line that still you're most concerned about is that top line. We've got Mike Fuda back. So you mentioned something. There was a lot in there, so I want to pick a few things out here, Mike. Your thoughts on this team's identity and what your concerns are specifically about it.
I just think, and I go back to 20, I think it was 2021, where, I mean, I know the way we won in LA and the way we drafted.
Yeah,
we had a lot of heavy players that weren't just necessarily fighters, but it was we were a real hard team to play against, surrounded by our skill. And unfortunately, our skill was pretty big too. Like, we weren't a smaller team like our Kopitars and stuff like that were big boys, but we had guys that could really bring it, and the compete level was off the chart. And we kind of were a rudderless ship as far as who the true leader was until Daryl Sutter came on. Daryl Sutter basically became our team captain. And everything else fell together, and we were a different team, and nobody could argue what our identity was. So I felt with the Leafs, when they made those moves, and I think it was probably in the Montreal year when they brought in Nick Foligno, and who's one of my favorite players in the game, and you know, they still had Zimmer and Cliffy. I think they had Jumbo Thornton and stuff like that. And I just felt they were finally getting it as far as a team. They, you know what, you didn't need to have a guy that just goes out. Nobody has a guy that just goes and fights, but they were really going to be hard to play against. And I felt if there were so many factors, you know, I felt if there was an atmosphere fan in the stands, that team would have been better, which is an excuse, but it's just a personal, I think teams that play with energy, especially the Leaf fans, it would help them. Tavares goes out early with an unfortunate injury. And Foligno gets hurt, right? And Freddie was very average in that. But I felt that they looked at that, in which I felt was a league that they were destined to at least get to the finals. And then we wouldn't be having any of these conversations about first rounds and all that stuff. That they just kind of ripped up that blueprint and said, we're going all in skill again. And that doesn't mean that I don't look at guys like Mark Giordano's one of my guys. He's one of my favorite guys. The guy's a warrior. But at his age, he shouldn't be. He's always going to do what he did last night. But really, there's the only guy on that roster that is capable of doing that. And that's just not really at this stage. And Jake Muzzin was expected to do it when he was healthy. And they're just not at that stage that's really in their MO for one thing. And it's just, I think there's an element missing that teams that have won, there's something there. Like even with Tampa Bay, who I know you guys talked about, that team took on the identity of Steve Yzerman. And they drafted players along that way that were going to have an identity. And they had still at the same time, they needed to add Barkley Goodrow, and they had Maroon and Richard Cernak and stuff of these guys. So they were really hard to play against. And even their stars were hard to play against. And they drafted the best goalie in the world. So I just look at this team and I look at a president who is one of my favorite players of all time, who clearly had an identity. And they probably don't make those guys anymore, so it's tough to find guys to make an identity on that. You've got Dubes, who seems to have a propensity for skill, which is fine in analytics, and Kiefer was an absolute savage warrior player, but he didn't play at the highest levels because he was injured. So it's sometimes when you're a star player to look back at a guy that hasn't been there, done that, you don't listen as much as you normally would. So I just don't see an identity of this team being, I see them as immensely skilled when they're motivated. And I don't see them hard to play against. And I think because of the odd injury that we've seen in the past, if one guy goes down, that back end does not look like a Stanley Cup blue line by any stretch of the imagination. If you were to tell me 10 games in that I had to pick an MVP, I'd be picking, no offense to JT or anything, but I'd probably be getting votes for Samsonov. That would just not have been my thought to start the year. So long-winded answer, but for me,
so where does,
it's one. Go ahead.
No, that's, I was going to say that. No, that's really good and thorough. The only question that I always wonder about this, and listen, you've sat in these chairs before and you've had these discussions. You know, no general manager outside of, I don't know, Bill Torrey starting the New York Islanders from scratch and taking them to a Stanley Cup champion, you know, does anything other than, you know, sit on the shoulders of those that came before them, unless you're in the position for like 20 years. Like, I look at this team and I'll look at, you know, you mentioned William Nylander a second ago, and you go back to the Philadelphia draft in 2014. And I say, well, okay, so who was around then? You know, Brendan Perlini and Nick Ehlers and Nick Ritchie, those were in the area where Nylander was going to get selected. And that's a Shanahan-Nonis pick. I think Nonis was still there. I think that's a Shanahan-Nonis pick. And then, you know, all the other sort of cornerstones on this team, those are all Lou Lamoriello picks. Huh? Mark Hunter's the head scout and Marner, et cetera.
Yeah.
But that's Lou, Morgan Riley. That's a Brian Burke. Like, I know a lot is sent Dubas's way, but a lot of these decisions, and I know the contracts are his, and he's got to wear those, and Tavares is his signing. But a lot of this was, a lot of that groundwork was, you know, laid by, you know, general managers, which are by and large pretty well respected around the league, and Brian Burke and Lou Lamoriello. You know what I mean?
I agree, but there's a lot of players that if you have a drafting philosophy, in which they, and it's clearly, I mean, there's incredible, if you look at the history of the draft, there's a lot of Russian incredibly skilled players, some small guys that are incredibly skilled. Mm-hmm. But I truly believe that you can draft you can draft a goaltender and develop them on your own. And they've got all the money to put towards development too, which they're not like some teams that can have that excuse to, yeah, you know, well, it's expensive to do the job. You should be able to develop your own goaltender. And I mean, I'm not saying everybody's going to turn out to be a Vasilevsky, et cetera, but you should be able to do it. Like, you mean, you see Carter Hart patiently, that if you've got a shot, you should be able to do it. I mean, we were fortunate. I didn't pick him, but we got a guy like Jonathan Quick in the third round. Like, it can be done, and the teams that usually win are the teams that have their own. And you, it's just, for me, you can find guys. If you go out and you put it in your scout's mind, I know we're looking for this, but you can find this somewhere. Like, when we used to draft in the seventh round, like, we ended up, we picked players in the seventh round, like, we'll be guys like McDermott, Jeff, Jordan Nolan, Nick Dowd. There was a element, Matty Roy, and those are just four kids. Like, we'd had this element of, mm-hmm, when you get in your, they were going after an element of size and grit and toughness that we can develop, we feel has a chance to be a player. And I mean, you look at this, I mean, I'm not even going to take a shot at how you pronounce his name, but someone like Wi-Fi in Montreal, like, if you're out in the rink looking for that element,
Yeah,
if you're out in the element looking for that element, I'm not telling you that, these guys were the right picks at the right spot. Like, Mitch Marner was a great pick where he was taken. But I just find that if you put a little bit of extra component on looking for that type of player, that doesn't necessarily cost you an asset. And now you've got a homegrown guy in your own system. It helps the identity of your team. So you're not, you know, and because last year when I was in Carolina, the one thing that Roddy Brindamore was adamant, he wanted Nick DeLaurier. And I happen to have drafted Nick DeLaurier, so that was my job to get Nick DeLaurier, and everything was set. We had everything set for him to come, and the owner decided that wasn't an element that he didn't want. But for a guy like, even like Rod Brindamore, you could probably argue that the Carolina Hurricanes and the Toronto Maple Leafs are two of the most skilled teams in hockey that lack that element to protect their stars, or just to be a deterrent. And you see a guy like Nick DeLaurier now ends up, I know, like, Philadelphia is a little overkill with what they're doing with their soldiers, but you get a guy like that, whatever he's making, he could have been had for 1.5 or 1.3, yet you allocate your funds to two smaller players on the fourth line. It's an organizational, you know, it's a decision what kind of team you want to build. And it's not an easy one, and we all make mistakes, but I just see that back end. And if all of a sudden, with injuries, Mark Giordano, who is at a point of his career where he's always going to be a Warrior, but if his minutes are at a certain amount, you're still getting Mark Giordano. But if you start to push him into Drew Doughty minutes, you're going to get diminished results. And Mark's never going to turn them down because he's a Warrior, but you just have to be really careful over an 82-game schedule how much you play someone like that, particularly when you've got someone like Musnell that's on the shelf.
You know, that's interesting about Carolina and DeLaurier, because it's always seemed as if, I mean, there are some exceptions. Think of like players like, I don't know, Jesse Bullerice, for example. Like, but, you know, you look at a team like Carolina, they've historically almost shied away from having that type of toughness in the lineup. You know what I mean? Like, there have been Scotty Walker was a really tough player, but like they've sort of always shied away from that.
Well, he brought their leadership group in, and Roddy obviously was a Warrior, but it's they don't play, they're not a soft team, but when they have to start nearly by the end of the season, and Tony D'Angelo was jumping in every script. We're doing the same thing as last, like Bunting right. and all these guys were doing last night, but it just doesn't have the desired effect when guys that you don't want doing that have to do that because they are good teammates and they care about their teammates. And he brought the leadership core in, and they did a silent vote, and DeLaurier was on every ballot for what the team wanted. And it's funny because Nick, when I drafted him, he was a skilled defenseman coming out of Trois-Rivières. So there's hands there. And he just realized it wasn't happening and morphed himself into a real tough guy that he's limited, but he goes to the net hard. He knows exactly how to protect teammates, and he is ultra glue in the dressing room. So, and I mean, we talk about Colorado's too. I think Nick's a better player, but like Colorado, I mean, I know you said McKinnon and stuff, but Curtis McDermott usually plays 82 games to make sure nobody screws around with those guys. Okay. And then they tell Curtis, you know, playoffs are coming, go grab things, some popcorn, go upstairs. Don't drop the Stanley Cup when you're at the bar after, which he obviously forgot about. But you know what I mean? So they had a Warrior. So you don't tell me that these guys didn't have a presence to look after their stars. Now, guys, obviously, you know, Ovechkin's a different guy because he plays such a hard game that he's very almost not have to fight because he hits harder than anybody. And it's just a different type player. And Crosby's kind of morphed into that player too. But those are special, special elements. And you know, they've tried to add those toughnesses to make sure Connor, and I mean, Evander Kane, you know, I mean, it's another guy you don't want doing it, but if somebody's going to screw around with McDavid, they're going to have to answer Evander Kane too, and Darnell Nurse. There's people there that do that. So it's not so much a knock. It's just something I feel, if you want to put your analytics aside and just do clear math, every team that's won has had that element or tried to acquire that element, and not necessarily, like I said, whether it's a Barkley Goodrow or a piece that's just like, or when the Leafs did it with Foligno. I mean, it's not like you're adding a goon at the deadline. That's not what it's all about at all, but you're adding a piece that just makes your stars feel a little better about themselves, keeps a little people on edge. And it's just, I think just by math, you have a few more of your guys a little less banged up going into the playoffs when they need to be fresh, because people aren't as, I've never seen, like, Jake Muzzin never got injured his entire time in Los Angeles. I'm not saying it's completely attributed to it, but I don't see any deterrent. I think first shift of the year, I think they were playing Montreal, and I think Josh Anderson might have put Giordano and Muzz through the glass like three separate times. And it's hockey, I know, but if you're not thinking twice about running guys, running stars, and running top guys, it's just, it makes it a tougher, it makes it tougher on the team in the long haul.
Let me close. That's some really interesting stuff there, Futes. Let me close on this one. For me, it's the New Jersey Devils. Maybe it's another team for you. Maybe it's New Jersey. Do you have a surprise team? The team that's really sort of captured your imagination? Like, tonight we're going to see the Devils and the Oilers. We know about the Oilers and how good they are, and they could win the Stanley Cup, etc. You know, Devils are really starting to jump up. We're starting to see even another gear from Brat. We're seeing another gear from Heischer. John Marino is having a real good bounce-back season for the New Jersey Devils, and they're getting saves. Do you have your version of Jeffy's New Jersey Devils?
Jeffy Heischer, do you have his picture in your wallet? He's a great player. He is a great player. But I look at, and it's good. Yeah. I talked about this one, and I kind of got the eye roll from DA on Hockey Central, because I went a different way with this. Because first of all, I'd be lying if I told you I got. I've been watching the Kraken at night. I don't have that seventh streak, and I followed them because I found it amazingly interesting how they looked so uncoached and disinterested last year. They seem to have structure, and they're getting some good goaltending, which helps. And they've added some grit. I mean, I used to babysit Bjorkstrand when I played in Denmark. He's turned out pretty good. And no, I didn't teach him how to do any stuff. He does it nice, but it's an amazing story. But for me, it's the Boston. For me, it's the Boston Bruins, and it's a different right. because I felt that Tampa, and this is where I get into. I got into one guy last night. I had to put my. I only had one beer, just so you know, Jeff. But he says to me, "Well, look at Tampa Bay. Look at Tampa Bay. They're off to a bad start." And I said, "But Tampa Bay has played, what is it, 16 rounds of playoffs in the last 3 years, and they've got two rings.
Insane.
So, okay, so don't make the argument against the team that's still trying to get out of the first round because they should be shot out of a cannon." Because they've had so much time and fresh, so they shouldn't be look tired or disinterested at the start of season. So for me, with Boston getting Krejci back, and I thought they were a team that was going to start to slide back, and they just seem without having McAvoy playing. I mean, they've been times without Carlo. I think this weekend they're without Forsberg, who's a real good penalty killer, and McAvoy, Krejci. Yeah. It's they just seem to have something going this year. Even the other night, they were getting pumped and they came back. Against a good team, I think it was against Pittsburgh. I can't, but they came back and won in overtime. I was like, there's something about this team that just seems destined that if we're going to get this dance together one more time, and Foligno, even a guy they put on waivers, is playing like a little reborn, like, I'm not going to let you put me on waivers again. And they have an identity. They look to me like the Bruins that they're hard to play against. They can get mucky with you, but they don't have to goon it up with you. And that for me, was the biggest tie. And I tried this thing I was thinking the other night because for me, I love the Leafs when they're confident. Okay. And if you're working hard and you're confident with that much skill, you're probably going to win. But if you play with arrogance and you don't work hard and you don't respect that, and it's a totally different feel. And I find that sometimes there's an arrogant style to them that you would have thought they'd already accomplished what they want to do by the way they play. And that just doesn't mix because you said, what did you call the Buffalo Sabres? Beasts or something like that? All these teams...
Oh, they're
that
a tank. The team's a tank. They're a tank.
All these teams that should have been that have been in the Leafs' rearview mirror are slowly getting closer. I don't think they're there yet, but there aren't too many nights that if the Leafs don't want to play confident and work hard, those teams aren't going to find a way to give them a game or actually beat them. And I don't think Boston's faded as quickly as I thought they had, and I don't... For some reason, Tampa Bay doesn't want to go anywhere. So it's just interesting to think that a team, it should be, they kind of like run away and you know they're going to be in the playoffs. So this next stretch of five games, you probably know better. I think it's, what is it? They got this week, and they got Carolina, which is going to be a huge test. I think they have Boston. They've got Vegas. I mean, McCrimmon was at the game
Boston
last night.
Saturday.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And Carolina. So these are going to be tests that if they're going to have to go in and play hard and play confidence, or they'll get exposed against teams like this. And that's going to be the litmus test for them the next five games for me.
They got Boston, they got Carolina, you're right. They got Vegas, they got Pittsburgh, and then they finish up against the Vancouver Canucks. That is the next five-game set for the Maple Leafs. One name that I want to throw out really quickly before we bid you good afternoon. I think a lot of this is Jim Montgomery. I really do. I know bringing Krejci back was great. Patrice Bergeron is back. You know, get the band back together one more time. I think we had forgotten because of what happened in Dallas, and he was an assistant last season. I think we had forgotten just how good a coach that Jim Montgomery is. And I'm glad that he's got his life together because he has the Boston Bruins together. He has them playing great.
And I'm glad that he got his, because this guy, we used to talk, I used to be in charge of putting, Dean would always say, give me some names from college that you think have it. And Tony Gasparini always said, you got to go in and meet Monty. When I met him, I was like, wow, this guy, his players love him. He's brilliant. And then obviously the stuff that inexcusable, but he did everything right to get himself back on track. And I called him and he just said support. Tavares been there in the good and bad times. And to watch the way they're playing, they just seem a little, I love Cassidy, but they just seem to be a little, there's a little bit more creativity. And I'll tell you what, this guy can put, he's got so much offensive. You probably seen him play. He's a very offensively gifted guy. So, it's fun to watch them play, and they seem to enjoy playing for him, and they seem to be rejuvenated. So if those two goaltenders can, you know, be what they're capable of being, they're going to be really tough to consider. You think, like, there's really how many, if you want to say number ones in the league, and I hope I'm not, if we got to get going here, but McAvoy is number one, right? So they're missing
Oh, for
the number one.
Yeah,
for number one. And then it's like, even in my last little Leaf fan giving it to me, you know we're going to get Carlson. And I'm like, okay. he may. And what are you going to give up? Because I know you're not giving up any of your top four. He makes 11.75 with a no trade, and you've got 50 contracts. So unless you're bringing him up here to, like, drop pocket the national anthem, get your head out of your They should be going after your sushi boy. That's the kind of thing they need.
Yeah. Yeah, you heard that. Yeah, I know a lot of people have called for him. I know a lot of people teams have called there. And Ronnie Francis is holding on for a reason.
Yeah, well, probably last because he's just such a long player, and he defends well, and he moves the puck well, and he's got some dirt to him, and he doesn't have a ridiculous contract. Yeah. So those are the kind of guys that are a little bit more feasibly attainable than getting the possible Norris Trophy winner just to come on for kicks.
Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen. You're great, Fuits. Always a pleasure, my man. You be well. From the NHL on Sportsnet, we've been talking to Mike Fiuta. Really, really interesting stuff there. Got to get Fiuts back on ASAP. Couple of minutes here before we get to Gary Lawless here at the bottom of the hour talking about the Vegas Golden Knights. They'll face off against Ottawa looking for win number 10. And Jack Eichel looks awesome. Let's get Matt Marchese involved here. How you doing today, Matty? What's a good word with you?
I'm good. It's still nice out and it's November, so, I mean, can't complain. That's for sure.
Yes, I hope you've done all of your leaves and winterized your palatial estate now that you have a little one running around. What spice in your chili these days? What do you want to get at?
You know what? Let's play the Mike Rupp clip because we did a bunch on the Leafs and we broke it down. Like, he does he does talk about certain things, but people know what happened last night. If you don't, find the clip. But this was Mike Rupp explaining Austin Matthews v. Travis Konechny.
Austin Matthews takes a shot by Travis Konechny, and I'm okay, and I love this, actually, that Austin goes after him, right? Goes in there, gives him a whack. You're not allowed. You can't just take a run at me, okay? And comes in, lays a cross check. That's all good. Konechny gives him a whack. Matthews gives him a whack. And then Konechny's like, all right, let's go. And Austin doesn't have to fight here. He does not have to fight here, although he's the one who kind of started this whole thing as far as going after him in the corner. But you can't just stand there and be okay with your teammates coming to your defense and you just laugh about it. We've seen this movie. I've seen this time and time again with Austin. Playing the cool card doesn't work. It doesn't float. It may scoot by. It may look cool on social media, but inside that locker room, at some point, it's going to wear thin. When you've got this situation, you've got a 39-year-old warrior that's been playing the game hard from day one, worked for everything he's got. He's got to come in here and fight this fight for you. You're going to smile, okay? That's the first part. Second part, Michael Bunting, Calder finalist last year, line mate, second year man. You're okay with him getting involved. There's Kelly Yarncroak, Rasmus Sandin, and here's the thing. Austin Matthews is going to stand here, and your situation in this is you grab onto somebody to keep it even, right? Look at the body language here by Matthews. One arm, barely up. Barely up. It's like a wet noodle. Touch, look away, turn around, look down at the ice. Won't even look anybody in the eyes. But you're okay with all this going on? All these other extracurriculars?
What do you think, Maddie?
I think he's right. I mean, go tell Mike Rupp he's wrong, first of all. The guy who's won a Stanley Cup, he's been covering the game since he retired after having a really nice career. And he's been in the rooms. He understands what goes on there. And when you watch it the way that Mike explains it, he's not wrong. Like, there's chaos going around, and Austin Matthews is literally just standing there. And I know he's not going to fight anybody, and I get that, even though, you know, it would probably do a lot in that room if he did. But I look at that situation like, just grab somebody. Just engage a little bit, because he literally just kind of watches everything go on around him. He looks down at the ice and everything's happening. Guys are grabbing other guys and he's just standing there and smiling. And it just, at some point, I do agree with Mike that act is going to wear thin. At some point, he's got to grab somebody. He doesn't have to fight, but he's got to pull somebody aside.
You see, I don't know what to comment about the act is going to wear thin in the room, because I'm not in the room. Like, I don't want to arrogantly comment on how his teammates feel, because I don't know. And what I do know is I would look at that situation and say, if I'm the Maple Leafs, I don't want Austin Matthews engaging at all. Now, as far as the smirking and the laughing while he gets thrown around, that's just Austin Matthews, you know, refusing to engage in extracurriculars. Your Ned Braden moment, if you will. You're a fan of Slapshot there, Matty. I know you'll appreciate that reference. The Ned Braden moment in the game against the Philadelphia Flyers. But I can't comment about the room. I can't comment about how Mark Giordano feels about Austin Matthews after the game or Michael Bunting or anybody. All I know is if I'm the Maple Leafs and I got a guy with a recent history of wrist injuries, the last thing that I want to see him do is drop his gloves.
Yeah, I don't want him to drop his gloves either.
With a lot of like old school hockey fans, like what's he going to do if he grabs someone? Like, you know, part of the thing that I think annoys people, and the older I get, the more I get annoyed with it too, is just the performance of the whole thing. Like, why do you have to grab someone? Because there's a large part of Olivet that is just a performance for the coach, don't you think? It's a big act. Look at me. I'm looking angry and I'm grabbing someone. To what end?
Well, I don't look at it. I look at it as just grab a guy so one of your teammates doesn't get pummeled after you started this. That's more my thing about grabbing a guy, is just making sure that your teammates aren't getting the brunt of it. Because, Jeff, at the end of the day, Austin Matthews pulled the pin out of the grenade, dropped it, and ran. That's what happened, basically.
I don't know. Swung his stick at Travis Konechny. They swung back. Konechny wanted to fight, and Matthews said, yeah, not interested. It's a blowout game, and I'm not going to wreck a hand. I'm not going to theoretically get a hand injury here for punching your bucket. Or punching your bare head, not interested. I think the thing that upsets people more than anything else is the smirking and allowing himself to get ragdolled so he doesn't get injured, which is interesting. I think it's the laughing and the smirking while Giordano and Bunting are in there making sure that no one goes near him. Again, this is the old school, new school divide, isn't it? Like, there's no reason for Austin Matthews to fight there.
No. He shouldn't fight in that situation. I agree. I'm just saying, like, you've got to just do your part. Just make sure that there's not a double team somewhere. Because if you're just standing there smirking, somebody's getting pummeled by one or two extra guys in that moment. That's all I'm saying.
All I know is nobody criticized Gretzky for essentially doing the same thing, getting out of scrums, getting out of situations like that.
Like, even Wayne Gretzky superstars fought once,
that have handled that well once. Actually, I think it was twice. The game against Chicago too. We always think of the Broughton fight. I think Grant Mulvey might have been his first. I think it was Grant Mulvey. So I think it might have been two scraps. Actually, wasn't Dave Taylor one too? So it might have been three. Now I have something to do this afternoon. Go look up Wayne Gretzky fights. I think that might have been three. I think Taylor, Mulvey, Broughton might have been the three. Anyhow. What was I saying? No one really went after Gretzky when everybody else had to fight his battles. Some guys can fight their own. There once was a day, you know, Dick Irvin would always remind me of this. Whenever I'd talk to Dick, he'd say, Jeff, don't forget, there was a time in hockey when the best players were also the toughest players. Whether it was Gordie Howe or Rocket Richard or Ted Lindsay, all these guys could handle themselves. Bobby Orr could handle himself. You look at even Sidney Crosby. Can handle himself. Thank you very much. But that's not everybody. Not everybody has to be the same when it comes to the physical element of. Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. But essentially, what I'm saying is, if I'm the Maple Leafs, I don't want Matthews anywhere near that. A couple of slashes on the shin pad. If Konechny wants to fight, the game is over. It's empty calorie time. Just leave it. Although, having said that, I can understand, given how Mike Rupp played and the teams that Mike Rupp played on. And again, I can't comment about the room. I'm not there, so I don't know how those guys in the room feel about defending Matthews when he's standing by smirking and laughing. I don't know. I will always defer to the players on that one. That is one area, Maddie, where I cannot offer any type of comment because I don't know. Let's hit a break. Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider, joins me here in a couple of moments. It is Vegas. It is Ottawa. That is one of 13 on the board. Vegas is hot. Eichel looks great. And Vegas is a force, once again, in the NHL. Gary Lawless in moments here on the Merrick Show.
Everything Raptors, before and after the games. The Raptor Show with Will Liu. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. This is the Jeff Merrick Show on the Sportsnet Radio Network.
All right, Vegas Golden Knights back in action this evening. They'll face off against the Ottawa Senators. Vegas looking for their 10th win of the campaign. Ditto Boston, who faces off against the Rangers. Oh, by the way, Jared McCann is a game timer for Seattle tonight. Dun, 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 dun. Does that mean Shane Wright gets in? Dun, 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 dun. Or is he scratched for the fifth game in a row? One of the sidebars to that game tonight. Vegas and Ottawa for comments on this. And Jack Eichel, someone he specifically sat down with recently, a year after the trade, is Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider. Gary, how are you today, pal?
I'm great, Jeff. How you doing, bud?
I am doing well. What did you take away from your most recent sit-down with the Vegas Golden Knights leader? Man, Jake Eichel's looking so good. Someone who we'll probably see in the conversation for maybe the Art Ross, maybe the Hearts. What'd you take away from your conversation with Jack, which you can read at the Vegas website, by the way?
You know, my first question that I asked him was, you know, it's been a year since the trade. What's it been like for you? And he took a really long pause before he answered. And, like, mm-hmm. was he emotional? I just kind of think it kind of hit him in the moment, because I don't know maybe if he'd thought about it. But we thought about it because, as a group, whenever we get to Ottawa, our broadcast and content team, something crazy happens. Like, we came to Ottawa in year three. This is where Gerard Gallant got fired. And then last year we came here, and this is when we were out for dinner, and Friedman texted me and said, I think you guys are getting Eichel. And the next morning, Kelly McCrimmon told the team at breakfast that he had traded Alex Tuch and Peyton Krebs away, and that Jack Eichel mm-hmm. was coming. And so we were thinking about it. We landed here. We kind of started laughing. It was like 1 a.m. and we're like, all right, who's going to get dealt here? And Dave Gosher turned around and looked at Ashley Weiss, our ringside reporter, and said, I hope you like Dallas, Ashley. And we all started kind of laughing and teasing her. So we were thinking about it, but he wasn't. Like, I don't think it clicked for him that, oh man, it's a year ago. This is exactly, because he wasn't in Ottawa. He was in Buffalo. Like, it didn't piece together for him. And it's not till Friday that it's actually 1 year. So he took a long pause before he answered. And then, you know, just, you know, it kind of really explained, you know, I've been through so much emotionally, mentally, physically, and now I'm just in this wonderfully great spot. He's really happy in Vegas. His teammates love him. He loves his teammates. And I don't want to give too much away about behind the scenes, but, you know, Jack sits in a spot on the plane where it's the big guys, right? And he's really part of that. And I think he's just having so much fun. I think he loves playing on a line with Mark Stone and Chandler Stephenson. I asked him, I said, you're 9-2. I don't think you've ever done that before in your career. And he looked at me and went, like, basically said, no, like, kind of laughing, you know? Like, he's never had this opportunity to be on a team that's really rolling. Yeah. And then I guess the next part that really fascinated me was I asked him about the success of the Buffalo Sabres. I said, you know, the Sabres are going pretty good. How do you feel about that? And he was like, well, I'm thrilled for them. And he went into, like, to explain that he had no ill will towards the organization. He said, you know, you have to, the sooner you understand that this is a business and that, you know, the Sabres had to look at what was best for their organization and I had the best to look at what was best for me, you know, the sooner you get to that place, you're better off. And, you know, I mean, like, He sold his house to Tage Thompson recently. He's really connected with those guys still, and is genuinely really happy for them. I don't know if that was true 8 months ago. Like, I do think that they're, you know, he wanted to do what was best for him physically. And it turns out Jack Eichel was right. Getting the artificial disc replacement surgery is way less. Well, a neck fusion, you know, when you fuse a vertebrae in your neck, you are the path to never moving your head again, right? You know what I mean? Like, that fusion wears out. In the first one wears out in 10 years, they fuse you again. Then they fuse you again in 10 years. And by the time it's all said and done, you just look straight ahead. You never turn your head to the left or right. And you have trouble picking up your grandchildren. So he didn't want to do that.
That for 1 second, Gary, because that's interesting. Do you get a sense from your experience with Eichel that he understands what part of his legacy is going to be in the game of hockey? Because it's already cemented. Because Eichel had the ADR surgery, and then Tyler Johnson had it. Joel Farabee of the Philadelphia Flyers had it. So, I mean, Eichel was the first. Like, regardless of whatever happens in Eichel's career, whatever he does, the successes he has individually or with the Vegas Golden Knights, there's going to be a place in hockey history for Jack Eichel, and that place is the first to have ADR, which has now become a commonplace to treat this type of injury. Does he have a sense of that?
You know, I have never thought to ask him that. I'll tell you this. Like, if that happens, great. That is not what he wants his legacy to be. He wants his legacy to be, he won a bunch of Stanley Cups with the Vegas Golden Knights. That's, you know what I mean? The other part of it is, and it's fascinating that you ask this, because this team is coached by Bruce Cassidy, who was one of the best defensemen, a young defenseman on the planet until he injured his knee in the summertime and was never the same again. Like Bruce Cassidy would have been a really good NHL defenseman for a long time, except for, you know, look what happened to Bobby Orr. So that's the thing to me. If some doctor had said to Bobby Orr back in the day, hey, instead of doing that, we're going to do this. And Bobby Orr's career would have been, you know, he could have stayed at the height of his powers for an extra 5 years. Like, imagine that. Imagine that would mean for Canadian hockey, for international hockey, let alone for the Bruins. Yep. You know what I mean? So I give Jack Eichel all the credit in the world for having the balls to stand up let's not forget he's a young man. And he, you know, you got all these people telling him, no, Jack, that's not right. We're going to do it. You got to do it this way. And he's like, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He stood up for himself, and, you know, a whole city dumps on him for it, which I think is really, really a shame. You know what I mean? Like, Jack Eichel didn't do anything to the city of Buffalo. Jack Eichel stood up for what? For his own health. Like, wouldn't we all want our son or daughter or friend or whatever, whoever, to do that? Of course.
Mm-hmm. There has been already this season, and we're talking to Gary Lawless, there's already been a couple of signature Jack Eichel plays that we've seen. And Vegas faces off against Ottawa tonight, and maybe we'll see another. To me, the nicest play I've seen from Eichel so far this season is that pass to Shea Theodore, the game-winning assist. Do you have a favorite Eichel play from this season so far?
The clear out move against Winnipeg with, you know, 10 seconds left in overtime. He comes off the bench, and Winnipeg is hemmed in their own zone, and Scheifele's been on the ice for at least a minute at that point in time, and his legs are rubber. And Jack just drags him around the ice then he brings him up to the blue line, and the bench yells at him 10 seconds. And then he just turns around and just, you know, blows by Scheifele and goes to the net and beat Hellebuck. Like, Hellebuck was, like, that might have, that was one of the best goaltending performances I've seen in a long,
He's
long
great.
Time. He was
yep.
out of his mind that game. And Eichel just, you know, at that point in time, it was like Michael Jordan. It was like, I'm taking the last shot, and we're going to win this game. Jack wasn't passing the puck. He wasn't giving it up. And It was really cool. He skated over to the boards, and he looked at his teammates. That's the part that I just loved. He looked at his teammates, put his arms out like, we just won, boys. And they were, and it was, that was in Vegas. The place was, my wife and daughter, it was a Sunday night, and they never come to Sunday night games. And someone offered them seats on the glass, and my daughter really wanted to try that. I looked down. They were still there. Like, they wouldn't leave. They stayed till the end of the game, which they never do on a school night. And, you know, my daughter was just jumping up and down. I got a text from her. By the time I got home, she was asleep. And then we flew to Washington the next morning. I got a text from her. And the next morning, she said, Daddy, can I get a Jack Eichel jersey? And, that kind of stuff is cool, right? You know, she's a big Mark Stone fan.
So hang on. Hold on. Did you get off your wallet and get the Jack Eichel jersey?
Well, we've been on the road. There will be. I have to talk to her. I got to find out what she wants. I got to find out if she wants the retro reverse, because they're like amazing.
Oh, right.
Or does she want gold? Or she has a white and a gray VGK jersey because she plays for the Vegas Junior Golden Knights. So she's already got the white and the gray, and she's got a Cody Eakin jersey from year one, but it's too small for her. So we'll have to figure out what she wants. Mm. But yeah, she's getting one for sure, absolutely.
And she's a nice little hockey player. Have you done your college tours yet? Has she decided yet where she's going to end up?
She, stubborn little girl that she was, lived in Winnipeg till she was six and wouldn't play hockey, and then moved to Vegas. And when she was nine, decided she wanted to be a hockey player. So she's just getting going. But she loves being on a team. That's her favorite thing. They travel a lot, and she just, the dressing room is, she's the last one out every night. She loves it.
It's the best, as are you. Gary, always a pleasure, my friend. Great job. You can read Gary's piece with Jack Eichel 1 year after the trade, available at the Vegas Golden Knights website, NHL.com. It's all there. Gary, thanks as always, my man. You take care. Enjoy the game tonight. It's Vegas and Ottawa, one of 13 games on the board this evening. Thanks, Gary.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks, Matt.
There he is, Gary Lawless, Vegas Golden Knights insider. I'm serious. Like, I know that, to Gary's point, this isn't, you know, the legacy that Jack Eichel wants to write. Oh, he was the pioneer of ADR in the NHL. I get that. But there's no avoiding it. And that is going to be, you know, a commonplace decision, I think, that a lot of hockey players make. I mean, we've already seen, as we mentioned, Tyler Johnson make the exact same decision. We've seen Joel Farabee make the exact same decision. I think we'll probably get to a place eventually in hockey. And I've talked to, you know, we had Dr. Ali Rendley on, you know, last year, talking extensively about it on the podcast. We had Dr. Prusmak on, who did the surgery for Jack Eichel. You know, I think we can all see a day somewhere down the road where a lot of the teams, and maybe even the Buffalo Sabres themselves, look at ADR and say, okay, you know what? It's not going to be a hard no from us anymore. that ADR is fine. I think you'll have 32 teams that all arrive at that same conclusion. And a lot of it is going to be because of Jack Eichel's decision. You know, there are a lot of ex-NHLers right now who had, you know, spinal fusion. Who had, you know, fusion in their neck because this option wasn't available to them. But now for a number of teams in the NHL and a lot of players, and perhaps it'll take a trade, as in the Jack Eichel case, but this is a surgery that is now available and plenty of players are taking that option. I'm not a doctor, so I don't want to say that, you know, a year from now something may go wrong or may not go wrong. I don't know. All I know is right now, part of the legacy of Jack Eichel is he was the first to have ADR, but he's going to be far from the last to have it. Thanks to Gary Lawless for stopping by the program today. Thanks to Mike Fiuta, who stopped by to talk about, amongst other things, Carolina's pursuit of Nick DeLaurier in the offseason. How about that one? Allison Lucan of the Seattle Kraken. It is the Kraken facing off against the Wild. Jared McCann is a game timer. That may open the door for Shane Wright to get in the lineup for the first time in four games. And thanks, as always, Elliot Friedman. We kick off every show because everyone's like, where is Elliot? What's he doing? Every day he goes for his walk when the show starts. And so essentially, we go for a walk with Friedge. Thanks for joining me. Marek Show back tomorrow across the Sportsnet Radio Network, simulcast on Sportsnet 360. Have a great rest of your day.